All right. So finally, we have from the Environmental Defense Fund, Nicole Saunders. She's an attorney with the U.S. Climate and Energy Program. So, Nicole, it's all yours.
Bringing up the rear. Thank you. Okay, so I am Nicole Saunders, like she said, with the Environmental Defense Fund. I just want to say thank you for giving us the opportunity to be here today and to speak with all of you. I think that I would agree with Todd that sound science matters, and this is a really big opportunity for the state of Texas to come out ahead and be a leader in really pulling together the questions like you laid out. What do we know and what do we not know, and maybe what we need to know to learn more about this process. So I'm going to present a little bit about better science and how that might be able to inform better policies. EDF, as most of you probably know, tries to do as much of our policy work founded and on foundations of really good science, really good technical development, so that we can go out and make the most sound policy recommendations that we can. We do a lot of work on oil and gas. I'm going to present on two areas that we're working on currently and have worked on for a number of years. So I'll start first with methane. So many of you have probably seen this slide, but methane, a pound of methane is 84 times the climate impact of a pound of carbon dioxide over the first 24 years. Estimates on this can actually range from 84 to 87, depending upon any additional feedbacks that are included. And I'll also note, as I begin this methane presentation, that you have Dr. Ramon Alvarez on your panel, as well as Dr. Allen. They are both intimately familiar with the methane work at EDF and elsewhere across the country. And if you have any deep-seated questions and great things to ask them, they will be here. I know Ramon will be here tomorrow to answer those for you. So just to give you an initial overview, EDF has started this program in 2012. We've done 16 peer review studies in collaboration with more than 100 academic and industry partners. And the results of those studies, in essence, show that emissions are higher than official older estimates. In Texas specifically, we have a coordinated research teams in the Barnett Shell that studied emissions from across the natural gas supply chain. The campaign used a variety of aircraft, vehicle, and ground-based measurements to conduct that work. And at the end, higher emissions were found than previous EPA inventories. In fact, researchers estimated that emissions were 90% higher than those estimates. And I should say now that EPA made major revisions to the 2016 greenhouse gas inventory, including the incorporation of data from three EDF studies, which increased the estimates of national emissions by about 33%. So our estimate of Barnett emissions is about 20 to 25% higher after accounting for those updates. So lessons learned, like I mentioned, higher emissions as a whole. Also that there's a unique, unpredictable, and widespread problem of super emitters that needs to be addressed. So there's a small number of components and sites that are responsible for a majority of emissions at any one time, but their identity is unpredictable, and they include intermittent sources. So frequent and continuous monitoring of all sites can allow us to quickly detect and repair those super emitters. And finally, regulations do work. While there are always leading companies that are willing to step out there in the front and voluntarily work to achieve emission reductions, regulations put everyone on a level playing field and ensure that across the chain, folks are working to reduce those emissions. Oh, this is my older version. That's okay. So there are a couple things I wanted to point out that aren't in this particular slide deck. One is that while some of our studies may be interpreted as low, emissions are actually big, and they are getting bigger. Across the United States, there are over 9.8 million metric tons of methane leaks each year from the oil and gas industry. The oil and gas industry is the largest emitter of methane in the United States. So just to give you a comparison of what 9.8 million metric tons is, that's about $2 billion worth of wasted natural gas, and on a 20-year climate impact is about 240 coal-fired power plants, which is about half of the coal-fired plants in the country. And so the way that we've kind of converted some of our science across the country into effective rules is portrayed in this, and I won't go into what we've done in all these states, but across North America, including Canada and Mexico, we're working to reduce methane pollution and aiming to achieve 40 to 45% emission reductions. And we're also turning our attention internationally, recognizing that this is not a U.S. alone or North America alone issue. So I'll talk a little bit about, I'm completely changing gears now to talk a little bit about water. And I wanted to talk first, before I get in too deeply into this slide, just generally to point out that produced water and water management issues across the entire chain of oil and gas production touch on every single subject that you've been talking about today. It touches on water, obviously, but it also touches on transport to land impacts, social impacts, and economics. Water is a key part of the question. So EDF itself is really thinking about how we manage produced water in a safe and in a way that minimizes risks to the environment. So viewed broadly, to take a step back, this includes just generally how do we minimize spills and leaks from operations so that produced water does not affect the environment, land, or local communities. Today, I want to talk about two more emerging issues. Oil and gas wastewater traditionally and today is for the most part disposed of in underground wells. But we learned earlier today about seismicity. We also learned about drought. And with those kind of issues in mind, regulators as well as industry across the country are starting to think about what can we do different with our produced water? How can we look at it differently? And how can we use it for our own operations? So I want to talk about alternative produced water management, but I want to be very careful to talk about it in two different buckets. So the first bucket is recycling. So the infilled reuse of produced water for subsequent operations. Cal gave a great presentation today of the success that Apache has had with this process. And Cal also mentioned briefly the need to be able to do this safely. And the question I think I would pose to this group and pose to you to think about is, what does that look like? What does it look like to have a large-scale recycling operation that doesn't potentially impact the environment or resources? So even as we consider what regulatory or economic considerations might exist for recycling, we need to have a parallel consideration of how we ensure that new risks aren't created that we aren't prepared to handle. So recycling involves higher volumes of water at the surface for longer periods of time. So this has new considerations for how you store, how you transport, how you treat, and how you manage residuals from treatment that you haven't been dealing with before. And so it's important that as we consider the positive benefit that we may get from conservation and from recycling, we need to also consider, how do we do this so that we're not creating a new risk in the name of solving another one like drought? So recycling is its separate issue, and I hope that this committee can come up with some good answers to those questions. But I also want to talk about reuse and discharge. It hasn't necessarily been talked about today, but it is a burgeoning issue to think about how produced water might be used outside of the oil field. So that involves a completely new set of scientific questions and technical considerations. This is a slide that kind of brings together a national overview of how states and regulators and elsewhere are thinking about produced water and disposal mechanisms outside of UIC. There's a lot going on in this slide. So this presents the volumes of produced water to begin with are shaded here. There's about 800 billion gallons of produced water. That's about 20 billion barrels in produced annually onshore in the U.S. Texas accounts for about 40% of that per the most recent estimates. So an overwhelming majority of that in Texas is reinjected, but Texas, like other states, has investigated and thought about the potential to reuse this water outside of the oil field. So for example, here's an example. In Texas was the Pecos Project. I don't think anyone has touched on that today, but that's a project that Anadarko conducted with a Railroad Commission permitted pilot. Texas A&M identified water parameters, and they did one cotton crop for one growing season with about 30,000 barrels from a single well on 5 total acres. An interesting tidbit to note from that project was that no runoff was allowed in that scenario. There are other places across the country looking at this. The Central Valley region in California has been treating crops with produced water for some time now. They are only now initiating a study or a project to think about what the risk considerations might be. And our neighbors to the north have a governor's task force looking at examining alternatives to oil and gas wastewater disposal because of their seismicity issues there in the state and also due to their 2060 goals for minimizing freshwater use. So if Texas moves forward and as the country moves forward with really considering reuse and discharge scenarios, there are a number of important research needs and research questions that need to be filled, like what's in this water? Can we treat it effectively to remove the constituents that we feel are of concern? Can we understand the potential toxicological impacts if it is released? And really this boils down to how clean is clean for this produced water to be used for another purpose? And there are some hurdles to coming up with answers to that question that I want to talk a little bit today. So we haven't had the need to learn more about produced water in the past because we've had a limited exposure scenario when produced water has been disposed of in underground injection wells. But with these new potential proposals, there are new potential exposure pathways, and therefore there are new questions. And that begins at the beginning with the fact that we really struggle to identify the chemicals that are actually present in produced water. Most of that comes down to the fact that we don't have the analytical methods capable of detecting constituents in wastewater in a high saline environment. Often there are matrix interferences that make detection complex and complicated to really get down to identifying all those constituents of potential concern in the wastewater. And in addition to that, there are beyond disclosure that we have at the state. Frac Focus has given us a lot of good positive feedback on disclosure. There are also transformational byproducts that occur downhole. There are also formation constituents that have just been there that are not there because the oil and gas industry put them there. They're just part of the groundwater. So because we don't have information on exactly what's there, there's kind of an awareness gap, right? That means we don't know exactly which chemicals are there. We don't know what we should be worrying about. And that's because we can't find what we aren't looking for. Our methane work used to talk about this at the beginning is not wanting to confuse an absence of data with an absence of a problem. And so if we don't have an awareness of potential constituents that may be out there, we aren't out there doing active research on exposure. So we aren't asking who or what may come in contact with this particular chemical. And beyond that, if they do come in contact with that chemical, what is the risk that poses? What's the hazard? And without good science on exposure, on hazards, there isn't the foundation necessary for us to really think about how we protect ourselves from this. So without knowing what's in the water, we can't design really smart treatment systems that are capable of definitely removing these constituents. And we also can't design good policy and good regulatory programs that can really make sure that we're out there testing for those constituents and monitoring as we go. So this is in a feedback loop because without policies on the books for a particular constituent, there isn't a need or an impetus to have an improved analytical method. Approved methods are really hard to get past at EPA. And so without those approved methods, we kind of end up back at the beginning with a problem on detection. I recognize this is an enforcement loop that is not unique to the oil and gas industry. I bring it up as a unique time in the oil and gas industries where we're investigating or thinking about these options. And there's a lot of brilliant technical scientific minds out there that can help us answer these questions. So I say that because I want to move on to this slide, which means that more research and science can help us start to narrow gaps. So in order to develop sound policies or even start asking the right questions before we even get to that stage, we need to know more so that we can fill in some of these gaps. Produced water may not be the solution for most things. It probably isn't in Texas, given the high saline water that we're dealing with. Danny and I had a good talk about this earlier. But if there's a consideration that it might be, there are a lot of questions that are going to be on the table from a wide range of constituents, including the public, of what do we know about this water? And how do we know that what you're doing is safe for us? And how do we know that it might not impact our soil, our crops, our long-term issues in streams in those areas? And more research that we can do at the forefront, the better that will be. So I'll move on now to talk a little bit about the science that EDF ourselves is conducting with funding from numerous foundations like the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation and the Heising Simmons Foundation. The Mitchell Foundation has worked with us as well on our water work. We're working with the University of Columbia and UC Boulder on two particular projects related to produced water characterization and treatment technology development. Our produced water characterization work is really honing in on that issue that we talked about that there just aren't the methods out there that allow us to get the most information we can out of samples of raw produced water. And that's important because it informs treatment technologies, and it also informs questions that we may ask about alternative management practices. So we're working to specific, we worked with a number of experts at an emerging issues workshop, and there came to be an agreement that there's a black box around organics. So we're working to see if we can expand the way that we can develop methods to detect more organics and detect them at levels that are informative. We're also working on treatment technologies and thinking about how we can efficiently and economically remove those toxic constituents. One of the technologies that we're looking at right now is the application of biological treatment in high saline environments. So that would be capable of potentially removing organics effectively in a saline environment, but also enhancing efficiencies of downstream technologies, because with organics removed, there's less potential, for example, fouling of a membrane downstream. So current studies have shown promise in waters of about 100,000 milligrams per liter TDS. And finally, I want to talk about a little bit about toxicity. So we've talked a lot about what's in the water, what's everything that's in the water, and how do we design treatment systems that will really remove everything that we're concerned about from that water. But there's a third question, and that's what's the toxicity? What's the potential toxicological impact of this wastewater if it's released? What might be the impact to land, to crops, to animals, to humans? And the EPA recently came out with a study that I'm sure all of you are well familiar with. And part of that study included a relatively limited hazard assessment, where they determined that of the 1,000-plus chemicals on their list that may be associated in some way with hydraulic fracturing operations or in produced water, they could find 87% of them were lacking what they considered key chronic toxicity data. So what do we do about that? What do we do about the fact that there's so little information on the toxicity of constituents that may be found in this wastewater? And EDF will be hosting an emerging issues expert workshop at the end of this month to actually pose that question. What are alternative mechanisms for answering questions about toxicity, even though we don't have that that data? So recognizing that it's a long way down the line before we can identify everything that's in produced water, and before we can take that even a step further and start thinking about what the toxicity studies might need to be conducted on those chemicals. Can we look at this whole effluent? Can we apply some new emerging technologies like bioassays, like whole effluent assessments that we've seen applied in other industries, and can we take that and apply it to produced water? And maybe doing so will allow us to add just at least a piece of toxicity information to signal a risk, even though we might not be able to have the specific toxicity information of every constituent that might be in that water. So that's an emerging issue for us, and it's an area where we're hoping to move further with some good sound science. So to wrap up a little bit on this issue, and I'm talking at this moment about the reuse and discharge scenarios, there's an opportunity to present what these key questions are. You know, how clean is clean for this alternative produced use? What does that mean? What's in the wastewater? What are the most effective technologies? What are the potential impacts of release? And how can we prevent or minimize unintentional releases like spills and leaks? And on recycling, which isn't present on this slide, I just want to reemphasize that we not only focus on the questions of how we encourage recycling, how we make it more economical, but also how we do it in a manner that doesn't increase risk to the environment. So how do we do it in a way that prevents spills and leaks, that looks at pits and tanks and how you construct them, what spill and leak detection is at those pits and tanks, looks at pipelines, looks at trucks, looks at treatment technologies, looks at residual disposal. So there are a lot of questions that are out there that could be answered and a lot of good progress that could be made when it comes to science. And finally, because I'm presenting on behalf of a lot of experts at EDF, I will switch for one slide to well integrity because I don't want it to be left out, and point out that EDF has worked with Southwestern Energy to develop what we call a model regulatory framework for well construction that's available online. It contains leading practices for regulators on well integrity, and Lori mentioned earlier the Railroad Commission's adoption in 2013 of a major revision to their well construction rules. Portions of those rules were parts of the MRF or relied in some part on the MRF. And Lori did give you her great stat that we've heard that after the adoption in 2014, there was a 40% drop in blowouts and a 50% drop in injuries from blowouts the next year, which is a pretty powerful statistic for good well construction rules and what that can mean for impacts on the ground. So what's next for Texas is to think about maybe formation integrity testing, area of review requirements for production wells, and considering refreshing the underground injection control rules. That is the end of my presentation. So I will go on to questions.
Okay, so this is now open for questions as well.
There you go. Thanks, Nicole. I wanted to kind of challenge a few of the things you said because I think they're worth challenging. This is a science organization, and you know, you asserted that it's very difficult in produced water to identify a lot of things. In fact, there are pretty well-known EPA-certified labs that routinely run 1,000 analyte analyses of produced water, and they seem to do it pretty successfully and swear that they follow EPA protocols. It may be true that, you know, if you're looking for parts per billion, it's pretty hard to do. But when you're looking at parts per million or even, you know, levels that you're worried about treating with your, you know, for any reason, there's plenty of available lab capacity in the United States to test that kind of stuff. So I kind of feel like I'm listening to, you know, an exaggeration of reality. And of those lists of 1,000 analytes, almost 300 of them were organics, many of them fairly complex organics. So I think a lot of produced water has been tested by a lot of companies and has been found to be pretty free of a lot of things. I also point out to everybody at EDF and the rest of the world thinking about what happens with frack water, the whole reason we put all those chemicals in it to start with is we want to do chemical reactions. Just remember that what's left over after the chemical reaction is usually not much of the chemical that you put in. Frequently, we are talking about parts per billion or less of residual chemicals that we've put in. Sometimes it's more than that if we're using acids or something simple. But just because it's on a list of a chemical we use does not mean that it's suddenly toxic, threatening, and very worrisome to the public. And then the other part of this is, you know, there are two examples that you showed where people are trying to reuse produced water for, you know, beneficial purposes, let's call it. One in California, one what Anadarko did in West Texas. And I would actually posit to this group of scientists, is that such a good idea for some of the reasons that you asked? What we're trying to do in the oil and gas business is recycle water, which means it all goes back down whole again. And there may be some dangers, if you like, while it's being stored and treated. That's part of an industrial process. There are plenty of industrial processes in this country that are much more scary than treating produced water, I assure you. Think about that. And I ask you, why scare everybody with stuff that's kind of marginal on the size of what people are trying to do as an industry? I'm all with you to focus on trying to make recycled water safe.
Okay. So I want to start at your point about the produced water characterization and the methods gaps that might be present there. We are actively at this moment within EDF working on developing a better analysis of what those methods gaps are. And what might be potentially constituents in produced water, and what analytical methods do exist, and the fact that they do exist doesn't always necessarily mean that they achieve accurate results. I'm sure that there are labs that have been able to achieve wonderful things. I'm not saying that produced water has not been tested whatsoever. What I'm trying to say is that the literature that's out there and our ability to understand specifically what's in produced water from play to play, from well to well, is limited by our inability to test it in some constituents for a number of methods. And just because a method exists doesn't mean it's helping us to detect that unknown area. And not to use a scare tactic by any means, but there are aspects of produced water that we don't understand. So we're working to try and determine what methods we might need to develop to do that. It may be that the methods are out there. It may be that they might just not be approved, or they might be research methods. And maybe we can work to bring those research methods into approved methods, and we can get all those methods out there, and we can move on. Another point that I wanted to make is that we do consider recycling and reuse very differently. These reuse scenarios, I would agree with you that the scientific community should consider whether or not that is the best and highest use of produced water to take it outside of the oil field. The highest use is most likely to do exactly what Cal and Apache is doing with it, and that's to recycle and to think about it safely. But we give this presentation and we have this conversation because there's a lot of conversation broader and beyond this room about reusing produced water outside of the oil field for other purposes, and we feel it's our duty as both an environmental organization and a scientific a group that tries to do the best science that we can to lay out what those considerations are and what the questions are if we are going to pursue that. I think that's...
Okay, and I think we probably only have time for one more. Or I don't know. Your hand was up first.
Just a comment. On the outer continental shelf, mostly produced water is disposed of in the Gulf of Mexico, mm-hmm. and that's true around the world. Mm-hmm. EPA does have toxicity tests that mm-hmm. all that produced water goes through, and it really is showing that there, at least as far as the shrimp are concerned, we are almost never have a problem with toxicity as far as the EPA test on produced water. Mm-hmm. Now, in one of your maps, you showed that beyond a certain meridian, and I always forget which one
right.
it is. Okay. That's been around for a long time, and the reason it's been around for a long time is because produced water has been used for agricultural purposes in those areas for decades. And the reason it is because in many of those reservoirs, the produced water has very low salinity, okay? And so it can be used with proper holding ponds and things like that. But we have decades of data on the use of produced water there.
Mm-hmm. And our toxicity work that we're doing is taking into consideration those studies because those whole effluent tests are applied offshore, both in the Gulf and also in the North Sea, is another recognition of a lot of good sciences out there in the North Sea on that.
All right. Well, let's thank our speaker.